Welcome, everyone. This is the LaRouche Show on Saturday, September 21, 2013. My name is Marcia Mary Baker, and our topic today is the spirit of the new Silk Road. Now, I'm going to say right up front, before any introductory remarks, this comes from the president of China having raised just this specific point more than once, I think, in recent days. And we have here our guest who to discuss this and the world situation at large. We have on the telephone Mike Billington, who is our Asia editor of Executive Intelligence Review. Welcome, Mike. How are you?
Good. Good to be here.
Good.
Again.
Right. It's not been for maybe 6 months, but Mike is, I want to say more about about you personally, Mike, in a few minutes. But as I indicated, you have a lot to say about Asia, about China, about, and so forth. But I want to open the show with a kind of near future vision to set the context, to kind of induce in people's minds what situation we're in this world. Next Tuesday in New York City at the United Nations, where the General Assembly of the UN is opening for its annual session next week, President Obama is due to give a speech. Now, can you imagine? I'm not going to speculate on what he might say, because who knows what the harpies, Samantha Power, the rep to the United Nations from the U.S., or Susan Rice, the security advisor, my goodness, what they might have him do, or on orders even from the worst crowd in London, not the good guys. But picture this. The president of the United States is going to be addressing the U.N. when we know that most Americans, whatever their apparent label or stripe, are completely opposed to launching some crazy action in Syria that would bring us to war. They've had it up to you know where with having been brought through the war in Afghanistan, Iraq, what happened in Libya, seeing what's happening in North Africa, Egypt trying to extricate itself from this. So Americans are completely opposed in majority to this president. They're opposed in a gut reaction to the condition of the economy, which is worsening by the hour. Yet President Obama yesterday in Missouri said, wow, isn't it great? Auto is roaring back. We have all these jobs in auto. I mean, this is the disparity between reality that people are suffering from and fear couldn't be greater as a distance from what the president and the people running him are saying. So keep that in mind. And with that, we want to review some of the developments in the world, and really from the point of view of the potential. Last night on the LaRouche Political Action Committee's Friday night webcast, where Mr. Lyndon LaRouche responds to a number of questions, what came through, this is the September 20th one, is that we're in a moment of great opportunity. We have tremendous potential for the good to pull away from the economic collapse, the dead monetarist system, and from moving ahead, especially to upgrade, upshift the entire economic platform by a recommitment and success in fission and fusion and thermonuclear power. So all of this was discussed, it's hanging in the balance, isn't it? You can admit you'll be hearing, as I say, if in protocol it goes through that Obama speaks next Tuesday, think how much is hanging in the balance for the good and for the evil. So it's from that point of view, we're very glad that Mike could be on with us today, because let me just point out a couple of things. For the last 10 months, there's been a series of new paradigm conferences held by the Schiller Institute, which Mrs. Helga Zepp LaRouche heads. They began last November in Germany, and then were held in San Francisco, New York City, near Washington, D.C. And at these new paradigm conferences, which is what we need, Mike attended them all and had a chance to meet with people from literally around the world, including from Asia. And then recently, in recent months, Mike was personally in Beijing in China, discussing with policy circles there the situation. So that it's from that broad perspective that we're glad to have Mike here, because it may mean it'll be news to some of you, not to others, that Mike goes way back in his collaboration with Lyndon LaRouche and other associates. In fact, he had the distinction of, at the time of the wrongful jailing of Lyndon LaRouche, Mike Billington was wrongfully sentenced to 77 years of combined sentence of state and federal courts, which I'm glad to say are behind us completely. But this potential for the good, Mike, would you please begin with a particular event that happened of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization about a week ago when they met in Kyrgyzstan, and say what it is and so forth, but it's part of the singularities that are moving us ahead with the potential to get out of the danger of war and into the real tasks of mankind. Mike.
Yes. Actually, let me start by, I just read through the webcast that Mr. LaRouche gave last night.
Okay.
And I think I want to emphasize one point he made. He was asked at one point about the extraordinary moves for peace that came from the totally unexpected agreement between Putin, or Mr. Lavrov, the Russian foreign minister, and John Kerry, which started this process of ending this insanity in Syria and potentially bringing a new Geneva conference and a peace conference there. And then the offensive taken by Mr. Putin in writing an op-ed here in the U.S., and now Rouhani, the new Iranian president, doing the same thing and posing again that we begin talking about the interests of the other rather than everyone just fighting for their own self-interest and ending this era of imperial confrontation and warfare. And LaRouche's answer was very interesting. He said, yes, this is all fine, but it won't work if we don't get the fusion economy, if we don't focus the world on the future, not just a future of peace, but a future of development. And without that development, there can't be peace. And I think this is an extraordinarily important point to make, is that we can't just be sort of lighthearted about, oh, can't we all just get along?
Hold hands, yeah.
You know, we have to fight for the future of mankind in the form of precisely this thermonuclear fusion platform for uplifting the entirety of mankind through science, technology, and culture, and the cultural revolution required to restore a commitment to the creative powers of the mind that we see equally in great scientific development and in great classical musical culture. So I start with that in order to keep that as sort of the focus of what we're looking at. The report or the conference that you're referring to was a week ago Friday in Bishkek in Kyrgyzstan, one of the stans in Central Asia, which was an annual meeting of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. It's the alliance that's been formed between Russia and China along with the Central Asian republics, Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, Tajikistan, and Uzbekistan, along with other countries that are sort of monitor this, such as Afghanistan and Iran, as well as India and Pakistan and Mongolia. So it's the entirety of the East Asia, Central Asia countries, with Russia and China sort of the focal point of forging the development policies required to transform the entirety of Asia and to deal with the strategic crisis in that region brought about by the new opium war in Afghanistan. The fact that under NATO's occupation in Afghanistan, opium production has expanded 40-fold, that basically, as the Russian drug czar, Viktor Ivanov, has said, this is a new British opium war, producing drugs this time in Afghanistan rather than India. But those drugs, more produced per year in Afghanistan than the entire world has ever produced in a single year, mostly being funneled into Russia and the Eastern European countries and elsewhere. largely there. So it is, it's an opium war, and it's British.
Mm-hmm.
It's the British apparatus which intentionally worked with the drug lords in Afghanistan to transform that country into the new drug haven. So they're dealing with this, and of course these are the funds then used to fund this international terrorist apparatus under the control of the British and the Saudis. So these strategic issues and the economic issues are paramount. What was different about this meeting is that Xi Jinping, who is a new president in China, who has decided that he can no longer simply talk about good things, but that these things have to be implemented, and is fighting ruthlessly, perhaps not the right word, strenuously,
mm-hmm.
Both domestically and internationally, to begin this process of building up the region in Africa and putting China on a course for development policies needed to sustain their country. And so, therefore, on his way there, he stopped in Kazakhstan and Turkmenistan and elsewhere and began laying out his perspective for this new Silk Road. And then at the SDO meeting, laid it out in some detail, where he said, what we require is, quote, an unobstructed route from the Baltic to the Pacific,
mm-hmm.
Transforming Central Asia from now a highly undeveloped, underpopulated, but resource-rich area into a hub, not just for extracting these resources, but for manufacturing, for building new cities, nuclear-powered cities, new plexes. And, of course, this has a long, long history in our organization. I'm sure all of our listeners know that...
you could recap it. It'd be good to recap, because...
Yeah, exactly. That Lynn and Helga, beginning way back in the 1980s, at the same time that the prosecution of LaRouche and myself and others was beginning, laid out a perspective for saving Europe and the United States from their imminent economic decline, which he had long forecast, by unleashing a development perspective for all of Eurasia. It began with what he called the productive triangle in Western and Eastern Europe, but then expanded into what Helga called the New Silk Road, opening up these connections between the Atlantic and the Pacific again. Which over the period of the 90s, while Lynn was locked up and myself and others, Helga spearheaded a drive working with the Chinese leadership, holding a conference in 1996 in Beijing on the new Eurasian land bridge, as the Chinese chose to call it. And that conference, at which Helga gave a keynote address and other members of our organization were there, along with many others from around the world and many leading Chinese both economists and scientists and engineers, laid out the perspective, which has proceeded. They have done the development of these three prongs, the northern prong being the already existing Siberian, Trans-Siberian Railroad, but improving that, and that's still a process that needs to be highly upgraded.
Yes, there's achievements along that, right? I don't know how far it's gotten, but go ahead.
Well, and then the central route, which goes right straight through Central Asia, through these STAN countries, and that's completed. In fact, in 2007, they had the first successful train load that went from the Pacific in China all the way to Holland, I guess, to Amsterdam. I guess the first one actually went to Moscow, but they now have connected that route. But there's huge problems with that route, and there's also problems with the southern route that goes down through Southeast Asia and then into Africa. The Central Asian route, I'll just mention the southern route through Southeast Asia, the main problem was that you had countries that were being demonized, like Cambodia and Myanmar, and therefore you couldn't even build anything, roads, let alone railroads, through these countries. But that's now been resolved, largely resolved. We have the potential of building this Trans-South Asia Railroad, and that's in the process. The Central Asia Road, the one that he's proposing now for the new Silk Road, which is literally the route of the old Silk Road, is the problem being that there's different grades, that some of these cars have to be transferred from one railroad to another because the gauge is different. And there's customs problems between these countries. It's not a high-speed rail, and so forth. So the idea here is let's be serious about this. Let's develop this this high-speed rail potential through this region, and in that way make it possible to transform this Central Asia region into it's a landlocked area, but we can turn it into a hub for development of all of Europe and Asia. And some of the Russians have made the point that in the far east of Russia, like in Central Asia, it's rather crazy to be developing raw materials, oil and other kinds of minerals, and then exporting them off to Europe or to China. Why not, in fact, have manufacturing hubs there, utilizing these potentials and increasing the potential for increasing the population density there? So these are the ideas that are driving this concept. I'll say one more thing, and then we can sort of go on to quit this.
Yeah, go ahead, yes. Mm-hmm.
But it's important to remember that China is also in very, very deep problems. On the trip that I made to China recently, which you referred to, mm-hmm. it was very clear from people from the government, from the party, from the think tanks, from academia, everyone is aware that the crash of the Western economy, the crash of the European and U.S. economy, the crash of the importer of last resort, as we used to call the United States, this is now collapsing under the insanity of this Anglo-British financial bailout of the bankrupt derivative bubble and the sacrifice of the great industrial progress that used to characterize America. And the Chinese wrongfully built their recovery. They were right, certainly, to open up and to move towards collaboration with the rest of the world. But against Mr. LaRouche's advice way back in the 80s and 90s, they centered this opening up on the idea of utilizing their cheap labor for exports from a few free economic zones along the coast where the foreign companies were given tax breaks. They were allowed to use cheap labor and, in fact, sort of recycled the labor that with people coming in off the countryside, unskilled, unprepared to do this kind of work, would work for a short time and then basically get burned out and would go home and another group would come in. It was a process of extracting export goods, consumer goods, for the West, for which China received almost nothing in return. All they got was pieces of paper called U.S. dollars.
Yeah.
We refused to sell them the high-speed computers, the technology that they really needed. We refused to help them build the basic infrastructure. So the Chinese themselves were committed to that kind of infrastructure development, but they didn't really have the capacity to do it and could not get the support mm-hmm. from the U.S., which was trying to, like an imperial power, just using the cheap labor to get these goods. And under the guise of saying we didn't want to sell them dual-use technologies that they might use for their military, heaven forbid, we therefore would not let them have the levels of technology, nuclear power facilities, and things that they needed. The result is that they're sitting on a huge pool of money, but that money is almost useless. They can't invest it anywhere, really,
right.
Because they did not get goods for their exports, and now they're faced with the collapse of that export market. They know they have to open up domestic demand. They have to open up real development internally in their own country and in their neighbors, which is what they're looking at with this Central Asia development idea. So they've always been committed to these points, but they're now under a huge pressure, because if you have a social breakdown in China as a result of the general global economic breakdown collapse, it's going to be catastrophic, social upheaval, and so forth. So they're very aware of this problem, but it's not going to be an easy one to solve. It has to be solved through the kind of collaboration between especially the U.S., China, and Russia that Mr. LaRouche has posed for many years. And as you know, LaRouche is also emphasizing in these last since this dramatic shift has taken place and the collapse of Obama as the one and the potential for unleashing these kinds of great development projects becomes real, that the U.S. can't do it on its own either. We've given up a lot of our productive capacity. We've given up our population, who has become dumbed down and drugged up and culturally deprived over since the 1960s and the green culture and the rock and drug culture and so forth. So we need to be in a global collaboration with these nations. We have to take up Xi Jinping's offer. We have to take up Mr. Putin's offer. We have to take up Rouhani's offer from Iran. We must recognize that our future and the future of mankind are at this point linked in realizing this leap to a higher platform that Mr. LaRouche has proposed. And let me just mention in closing on this, on the very day that this new Silk Road proposal was being made at the SCO, we released here, under our 21st Century Science and Technology, our basement group, released this extraordinary report called Thermonuclear Nawapa 21, a new platform for development, or a gateway to the fusion economy, I think is the subtitle. And this lays out both the higher level of the Nawapa development program, but especially the taking of this scientific and technological vision of the future into the Pacific region through the Bering Strait Tunnel that we have to make, the rail connections that the Russians are already trying to develop from their Trans-Siberian up to Alaska, down through China into Southeast Asia with the Kra Canal, for which we're releasing a video today, I think, or today or tomorrow. So these are all great projects that are just so incredibly inspiring. But it's just that we have to recognize that these things cannot be done if we don't deal with the collapse of the financial system, the implementation of our Glass-Steagall fight. It's all within our grasp, but it has to be taken as a totality, as a refocusing of the minds of human beings on the future and on their capacity to use their minds to think in the future, and then make that determine the present.
Right. Well, a number of things there. Let me just make sure to throw in, people should know who are listening to this, that will mean LaRouchePub.com, that it's the September 20th issue of EIR Online that has your article in it, Mike. It's called Asia Looks to the Future. Can the U.S. follow its lead? Which you just said, we should listen to President Xi, President Putin, President Rouhani in Iran. We have these. And we certainly have Mr. LaRouche himself and voices in the Americas saying we should have a future. So Asia Looks to the Future, Can the U.S. Follow Its Lead is September 20, and the issue has a map of the main primary and secondary routes of the Eurasian Land Bridge, which, as you said, Mike, were laid out in a report put out in 1997 by the EIR News Service as a special report. So it's historic. Talk about looking to the future. That's what we should have been doing all along, but we're not going backwards now. It's a necessity to go ahead. And in that sense, there, to follow up on a couple of things as you open up, just on the negative side, Mike, I'd like to throw in here what you say about it's crunch time. The economic situation in China, despite all the commitment, which is critical for technology, for magnetically levitated trains, for going to space, for nuclear power. But the actuality is, I'll mention on food, because that's a daily necessity, the idea of selling cheap to the West, it prevails too in the line of food, where China's been committed to national food self-sufficiency, but is not able to do this under the lousy world economic regime, the monetarist regime. So for principal crops, much of the time, like over half of all the soybeans consumed in China must be imported. China's following a policy then of exporting what they call high-value foods, canned mushrooms, peaches, pears, apple juice. Go to your regular supermarket or go to the dollar store and read the labels. And so this is a kind of relationship which does nobody any good, anywhere in the world, which persists, which is part of what I'm getting into the nitty-gritty. We don't have to pursue that. But as in Mike's article in the EIR, you say that Xi Jinping, the president, was very specific among the things he said we have to have cooperation on: energy development, transportation, but also food security all along the New Silk Road, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, these are huge underdeveloped areas that can be developed for agricultural development. It's mountainous areas and there's problems with the land and so forth. But the big problem is water, as everywhere, as here. Just as our NWAPA program, as again, I'm sure your listeners know, the whole focus of that NWAPA program is to increase the productivity of water. Instead of allowing water to be wasted for it draining off into the Arctic, we bring some of that water down into the Great American Desert. That water then becomes more productive because it gets evaporated and falls as rain, so it gets used over and over again. And in that process, you create green, you create, which itself, through the miracle of growth, of plant growth, creates higher levels of water throughput. So the scientific approach to greening the deserts, which we can do here in America and double our food production here in the United States, is equally true in Central Asia and other parts of the world where water is the primary problem. You have land, but you need to actually bring in water through various kinds of projects, NWAPA-style projects, which can turn these areas into productive agricultural areas. Again, you have to mention this drug issue. There is a very productive drug production area, not just Afghanistan, but these other countries of that region. There's huge amounts of drugs produced there because they grow well and because they're not adequately governed. There's huge corruption in the government because the drug business, the largest business in the world, as Maria Costa, the former UN drug czar, said, our banking system is addicted to drugs. And that fact, what we published many, many years ago in our book called Dope Incorporated, that in fact the drug business is the banking business. They're the kingpins of this international drug business. So don't think that the drug problem in Afghanistan is just local drug lords. It's the same Anglo Wall Street banks who have actually been caught over and over, like the Hong Kong and Shanghai Bank, HSBC, which was caught laundering drug money from Mexico and elsewhere. And like always, got a little slap in the wrist and went right back to business, because nobody from the banking community is going to be prosecuted or go to jail, even for running the biggest drug business in the history of mankind, while millions of young kids who were caught up in this drug thing, waste their time in prison. I met a lot of them when I was there. But that reality is one which demonstrates that these are productive areas. If we can get the required water and the commitment to that kind of production. I don't personally know that. Perhaps you do, Marcia, in terms of the productivity of that whole Central Asia region.
Well,
productivity.
Let me throw in one example, and it was, take Afghanistan. Take during the Eisenhower years, I believe, Adams for Peace and so forth. There were mutual U.S. Missions and projects regarding agriculture in Afghanistan, which of course has great certain areas at a great height, but traditionally, I mean hundreds of years back, is famous for things like cashews, apricots, barley, millet, certain kinds of things it can produce, it has an agriculture a legacy and a potential. Now, what just as you just described, that the world banking system today is part of the drug system and depends on those flows, as you said, Maria Costa, this international figure in UN circles pointing out the how much money of the drugs is goes right into propping up banks. The world food system today, under the Anglo-Dutch and related cartels, is part of the drug system. What do I mean by that? If you had nations producing, even today without all the leaps that we must have and can have, producing what's possible in their agroclimatic potential, like in Afghanistan, you'd be producing just what I said, the stone fruits, the plums, the apricots, all the things that everybody there has known how to grow, the small grains, you'd be doing that, the nut crops and so forth, because you'd be intervening to say, you will have a guaranteed price for developing these nut groves and fruit orchards and small grain fields. You'll have a guaranteed price, in fact, a bonus for producing that. We will burn all of the poppy fields and any poppy seeds and anything we have around. And so, fine, people would do it. But as our India correspondent, Ramtanu Maitra, often points out, none of this is done. You'll have a few individuals say, we're against drugs, we want to penalize farmers who produce poppy. That's just for show. You create the conditions where you can produce food. In a way, Mike, it's morally parallel to the United States, where in our big rain-fed agriculture areas of Iowa and eastern Nebraska and Illinois, we can produce corn, sometimes without, most of the time without irrigation. That's famous here, that you don't need irrigation all the time. But we're burning 40% of that product for biofuel. So in the same, and that's part of the world so food
we're,
system.
We're burning corn instead of poppy.
That's right. So we, so I've developed a few connections here, but that's one area, the old Aral Sea Basin, which other than Turkmenistan, which I don't know is a member of the SCO, but Kazakhstan, other the Fergana Valley and so forth. It's long known. It's not an agriculture problem, what we can do. It's part of the world dead monetarist drug system that's preventing us from doing it, preventing us from saying, we'll pay a premium for young people to go out there and work on the new farm. We'll pay a premium for whatever food or fiber crop used to be cotton. That was part of a problem too. So none of that is the problem. It's the policy, which of course is where we started. We have now new policy pronouncements from this Eurasian part of the world, from Mr. Putin himself, from Mr. Rouhani, Iran. That's another important area of wheat growing and great agriculture potential. So I think that we've developed that what could happen and what must happen. And maybe you should say a few words, though, before at this time or later before the show ends, though, on the still active thrust to undermine and otherwise demobilize China by these initiatives in the Pacific called Asia Pivot or called Trans-Pacific Partnership, that kind of thing.
Air-sea battle.
Air-sea battle.
Let me give another one first, which is on the drug issue in Central Asia and in Afghanistan. For those of your listeners who have not already read the extraordinary interview that that we did with a man named Konstantin Sorokin. He's one of the Russian members of a joint U.S.-Russia team dealing with the international drug crisis. He was the author of a report called Afghan Narco-Trafficking, a Joint Threat Assessment, and he was working with some Americans on this project. But it's a powerful interview which demonstrates clearly what he says in one sentence, which is the West, this is a quote, the Western countries do not want to move for complete opium crop eradication, although they are well aware of the consequences of not doing so. So, and this is as clear as you can be that this is a new opium war. It's intentional. They, and of course, when we pull out of Afghanistan, if we do next year as planned, it's going to be worse. It's going to be largely under the control of the drug mafia, which, again, is not local warlords per se. It's the international banks who are controlling this process, who make the money. It's not the local farmers who make any money off of this. they'd move, do much, much better under the kind of system you just laid out with parity, where they knew they'd have a life rather than living under.
They'd switch
Their
next year. You give them the
stressors.
seeds and the money, they'll do it. Right.
Yeah, exactly. Right. So otherwise, on the China issue, yeah, this is also what I learned in China, which I expected to learn. I was not quite as expecting that they were as much on top as the great economic danger to China, but they are. But they are very aware of the war danger and of the isolation of China under the Anglo-Obama policy. There is two prongs to this. There's the outright military isolation. The U.S. adopted officially a doctrine called air-sea battle, which was drawn up by people within the Pentagon who are long on history to Andy Marshall at the Pentagon, who's an anti-China fanatic. And that this policy is not really a strategy for the United States military in the Pacific. It's simply a war plan. And as many critics, not just ourselves, but now a growing number of people in the military itself, including General Dempsey, the head of our Joint Chiefs, who has, while he's had to go along with this as a doctrine, has strongly opposed this attempt to confront China militarily, and has personally made sure that our military alliance with Russia, with China, is strengthened at the same time that this insanity is being pushed by the White House and by those layers in the Pentagon who were tied to this Anglo crowd of confrontation. What the air-sea battle is essentially is that says the Chinese are developing, they're growing, and therefore they are a threat. This is what's known as the Thucydides trap, and General Dempsey has been very outspoken on this, saying we must not fall into the Thucydides trap. This is Thucydides, the historian of ancient Greece, who said that Sparta and Athens went to war simply because there was a growth of a threat coming from Athens, or was it Sparta? I forget which way it was. But that seeing the growth of another power point, they decided, well, therefore we have to go to war. This idea that we must be adversaries of a new power in the world is the core of British or any kind of imperial history, going back to Roman Empire and the Venetian Empire. Anytime you see a power growing in the world, you unite with other secondary powers to destroy that power so that you remain the key controller of a relatively backward world economy and world political structure. So that imperial thinking, the oligarchical system, is what's on the line here. It's not just another occurrence. This is end game. We're in the thermonuclear age now. If we end up giving in to this push for confrontation, for instance, in the Chinese case, they say that because they're growing, they're going to have a navy which can move outside of the so-called island to the first island chain, which is the Philippines and Japan and so forth. If they're capable of moving outside of that, that's a great danger, just by the fact that they're moving out. And inside the first island chain, they set up all of these crazy territorial disputes over islands and rocks in the South China Sea, and accuse China of being an aggressive power trying to take over these little rocks and so forth. And therefore, the only way to deal with that is by building up a military force. And this is not just talk. What we're doing in the Philippines is an abomination. Mm-hmm. We have, despite the fact that the Philippines threw the U.S. out of their military bases at Clark and Subic Bay back in the 1990s, and wrote into their constitution that never again will there be foreign bases on their shore, this current president, and the last one, but this president especially, Noynoy Aquino, the son of the Aquino family, which was put in power when their last great president, President Ferdinand Marcos, was overthrown by George Shultz and Paul Wolfowitz and the neocon crowd here in the United States back in 1986. He's back in power. He is signing agreements with the U.S. to allow our nuclear subs, our nuclear aircraft carriers, our strategic aircraft to use those bases again And they're saying, well, they're not U.S. bases. They're still Philippine bases. We're just allowing them to use them on a rotating basis and troops. So that effectively the U.S. is moving in to reoccupy the Philippines as a Air Force naval station for a confrontation with China. And of course, we're also beefing up our anti-ballistic missile systems all along the Russian border from Guam, Japan. There are new ones in the Philippines they're proposing to build, and so forth. And a major base operation being set up in Australia, including our heavy long-range bombers and so forth. Mm-hmm. So this is, the Chinese see what this is, just as the Russians recognize that the anti-ballistic missile systems being set up on their border in Europe, which the U.S. says, oh, don't worry about these. We're only protecting against Iran's missiles, which they don't have. And as the Russians see, these things are pointed straight at them. They're aimed at being able to attempt to take out their nuclear counterforce, which means they're preparing for a first strike against Russia. And the Chinese recognize the same danger. So this is how close we are, as Mr. LaRouche repeatedly points out. We're on the brink of thermonuclear war. Anything could spark these things. The lunacy that we've had with Obama is just totally allowing himself to be a puppet spokesman for this British Tony Blair imperial fascist policy. Has brought us as a world to the brink of thermonuclear extinction. And therefore, as LaRouche has posed in this whole thrust, we have a choice. It's going to be thermonuclear development or it's going to be thermonuclear war. There's no in-between at this point. We're in a different age than in the past. We can't have a world war from which we suffer horrible damage and then somehow, you know, manage to recover. This is the extinction of mankind if we don't move to stop this fight. And then secondly, you mentioned this so-called Trans-Pacific Partnership, TPP.
Yes.
This was, again, launched by the U.S. They didn't hide it. The Carla Hills, the old trade rep from the United States, said quite publicly, we decided to launch this Trans-Pacific Partnership as sort of a coalition of the willing, the same as Mr. Obama was trying to form to go to war against Syria, a coalition of the willing, the way Bush did with the coalition of the willing against Iraq, since you couldn't get the UN and the world united behind a policy because it was an abomination. They just said, well, who are our puppets that will follow our instructions? Then let's put together a coalition of the willing. So we formed a coalition of the willing as a economic free trade pact explicitly aimed at isolating China. And as Carla Hill said, it was China making headway in forming relations with nations throughout Asia that were based, and these are not her words but mine, which were based, unlike our policies, where we give them some money to pay their debt in exchange for conditions, where they have to restrain development, they have to not have big projects, which are called boondoggles. They have to constrain their welfare payments to the poor and so forth. Instead, China says, we have no conditions. We will build the infrastructure you need. We do need to buy some of your raw materials, but we'll pay for them, unlike the West, not with dollar bills, but with infrastructure, with things you need to build up your economy. So the free trade fanatics in London and New York saw this and said, well, it's got to be stopped. This is dangerous. China's making headway, economic friends throughout Asia. We have to have our side, which is free trade, free markets, conditionalities, no state sector, right? Well, you can join our free trade pact, and we'll give you a few goodies, but you have to agree to give up any state power, state role in your economy. No state sector industries. And of course, you have to agree to allowing international financial interests to determine the price of your commodities, which is how these countries end up getting screwed in a time of crisis, and so forth. But they've got certain countries that are going along with it, the Philippines, of course, and others, including some countries in South America. And the idea here is to is to try to isolate China, to use this as part of a general anti-China ideological as well as economic confrontation and circlement of China in order to bring about this desired confrontation at the military level as well. So these things, these are all going to fall apart. I mean, in a certain sense, you don't want to make too much out of this stuff. It's going to go because Obama's going to go. He's finished. He's now being ridiculed by his own party base, by everybody, by around the world. He recognized that he cannot act as if he's God anymore and dictate policy, because finally there's been a revolt against these insane wars, and increasingly there's a revolt to impose LaRouche's idea of a Glass-Steagall in states around the country, which has provoked the enemy, the Wall Street London crowd, to, in a panicked response, send out their big powers to try to counter even local states that are moving in this direction, which is not a sign of their power. It's a sign of their desperate defensiveness. And if we see that this is a time where we can and must drive through Glass-Steagall now, use that as the basis for saying, look, we can create a new creditary system. And for anybody who has trouble understanding what a creditary system is as opposed to a monetary system, it's really very simple in light of what we're proposing with this new thermonuclear platform for development, with the new Silk Road, with the Kra Canal. If you have a vision of the future of transforming nature and transforming mankind through transforming nature towards the increased productivity of the human race, towards creating both the physical infrastructure and the education and health facilities infrastructure needed to bring up the entire population to a higher level of creativity based on the creative power of the mind, then that creates a basis for a credit system today. And that's what a credit system is. It's the future, as opposed to a monetary system, which is just pushing money around with no difference between money that's used to build a steel mill or a whorehouse. There's no distinction to money. Money is stupid. It doesn't have any idea. It's just, what can it do to get more money in return? Whereas credit is based on the American system concept of Republican government committed to the future, laying out the perspective for how to uplift the entirety of the nation and mankind. And then that is the basis on which a credit system is established today, that you can then issue credit knowing that you're going to be building up a future which will make it easy to repay these debts, to maintain an expanded tax base, to have productivity increasing not only in the area you're investing in, but across the board. This is the American system of Alexander Hamilton, which we can and must restore today, and which we have every reason to believe we can do if people take themselves seriously as human beings at this time, and not as simply beasts who just, you know, basically take care of themselves and don't think. But if we have that mobilization, what this LaRouche mobilization in the United States has proved, it can work, because the American people have responded. They said no to the war. They're saying yes to Glass-Steagall. It has to expand quickly. We're still in an extremely, extremely dangerous situation. But these things are possible, and that we have the allies in China, in Russia, and I haven't gone into it here today, but we have very close friends in Japan and Korea who want to make this happen, who can't take the lead themselves because these are still basically occupied countries from the World War II time and the Korean War time. So they can't take the lead, but they have tremendous science and technology potential, and they want to see this development, and we can bring those countries along to play a dramatic role in the development of the entire Trans-Pacific region, and from there, of course, the entire world. The big fight is going to be Africa, which has been so destroyed over these centuries of colonial power and neocolonial power. It's an area that's going to require a huge input of resources from across the United States and the Pacific region, the Asia region. But this is what's in our grasp. It's right within our hands if we simply take this moment, this incredible moment in history.
Right, that's a terrific overview, and everyone listening, hundreds, well, thousands of people in the United States have acted with Mr. LaRouche and the LaRouche Political Action Committee and others over the last few years to to put forward the idea of stopping the dead monitor system with the Glass-Steagall reintroduction. And that's really, I just want to say, Congress is in session, and it's miserable in what it is and isn't doing. But in the hallways, literally, as one of the some of the people on the Capitol Hill told me yesterday, you find people, you're walking down the hall to the cafeteria, and you see hear a little conversation, a snippet of conversation, where somebody says, "Psst, psst, reinstate Glass-Steagall." In other words, this is everything is at the surface, ready to be actualized, thanks to a lot of the effort and the conceptualization. And really, the what you just said about, and what Lyndon LaRouche said last night about the commitment to science and succeeding in going ahead to succeed in the fusion, in the controlled fusion reactions, where we've just been funding it at a below success commitment for the last several decades. This kind of situation is summarized, a portion of the new report you mentioned by 21st Century Science and Technologies, in the same EIR issue, September 20th, as your own article, Mike. And without getting into the energy side, before the hour's up, you take certain things that have been on the agenda for decades that are so obvious, and like the Kra Canal in the Isthmus of Kra in the Southeast Asian region. We have that in the new 21st Century Science and Technology report on nuclear Nawapa 21. And this, I'd like you to say something about it, your
Yeah,
personal.
let me mention this video. It's really it's, we've been working on this for a year. It's
Thanks.
been put together by Megan Roulard and Oscar Saito, two of our basement members, Percival members. Oscar unfortunately couldn't stay in the U.S. because she's Japanese and she had visa problems, so she's now in Germany. Megan has, in collaboration with her overseas and with help from some of the other people here in Percival in the basement, have now completed this video. It includes an interview with Pakti Thanapura, a longtime friend of the LaRouche movement in Thailand, in Bangkok, who is the has been the head since the ninth. Well, actually, in 1983 and 1984, Mr. LaRouche attended and co-sponsored a conference with the Thai government and with the Japanese Mitsubishi Global Infrastructure Fund on the Kra Canal, on building a canal across the southern tip of the Kra Isthmus of Thailand, which would avoid that very dangerous and very narrow Malacca Straits, which, if our trade had developed as it should have since that time, would already be so overcrowded, as well as dangerous from piracy and things, that we would have to have another route. But it would also turn that area, which is by itself also a strategic difficult area, because there's insurgency down there having to do with the difference between the Buddhist and the Muslim population. But if you build this Kra Canal, cities at either end, industrial development, it becomes the hub for the entire region, of a new uplifting to a higher platform. And Megan, in this video, has taken this canal, which is now with the interest in this is restored with interest from Japan, from China. Our friends in Japan see that since both Japan and China would benefit enormously from this canal in terms of all the oil and so forth, and goods to come in from the Gulf have to come through that region, it would be a tremendous benefit to all the East Asian countries. But more importantly, they say, look, if we can get China and Japan together with the Thai government to sponsor this canal, to guarantee long-term investment, this would serve as a basis for overcoming the China-Japan tensions. In other words, it's the peace through development idea. Get joint development projects that serve all of our interests, the interests of ourselves and the others, as a basis for overcoming these manipulated confrontations that are based on territorial or historic issues. Look to the future. So this video is going to be released tomorrow, I think, or maybe even today. It'll be posted up on the website, and I would strongly, strongly encourage everyone to look at this. It's about a half an hour long. It has an interview with Butch Valdez from the Philippines, excerpts from Pakti, and some beautiful use of Google Earth to show both the canal development and discusses the whole nuclear development of the region. It includes something called the Southeast Asia Water and Power Alliance, developed by a friend in Laos, Tone Sherawat, who has developed a concept for taking the enormous amount of water that falls in landlocked Laos and using the Wapatite principles to use that water for development of the entire region, including parts of China. So all of this is put together. It's a very inspiring video. So I'm anxious to hear what people think about it, as well as using this to help organize some of your friends and others to see this vision of what we can achieve on a global scale.
Right. And once again, this is an example of a critical, but you step back from the planet Earth and you see obvious places where mankind should be intervening to upgrade nature, such as the Panama Canal. And this Craw Canal has been envisioned during the time of Adams for Peace. It was explicitly looked at it as a place where you could use peaceful nuclear explosives to do it fast, not have to take a several years long in construction time period. But in the Great Game, that's another name for that's become famous for the British Imperial playing off and creating strife, playing people off against each other and preventing any projects, especially in the Central Asian region, but anywhere in the world. Mike, I think it's true that literally the British, if not the Dutch, was insistent that the Straits of Malacca had to be the only transit zone, that Singapore had almost to be the toll booth for that part of the world.
Absolutely.
And they were going
to end of World War II, it goes back further than that, but okay. At the end of World War II, the British just said outright, we are going to treat Thailand as an enemy agency, because they refused to fight the Japanese. They knew they couldn't. So they just basically submitted to the Japanese occupation. But at the same time, built, working with the OSS, had a free Thai movement that was sabotaging some of the Japanese operations and working with America to prepare for the future. But the British came in and said, we're going to punish you. We want to take your rice to feed our troops and others in Asia. And we forbid you to build the Craw Canal without our permission.
Okay.
They knew what they were doing. They wanted their Singapore outpost there to have the power to not only control the Malaccas, I mean, to control the trade, mm-hmm. but to shut it down if needed. In other words, it's a choke point that can be used strategically against countries like China. So, yeah, this is a classic British imperial fight. And again, we can beat this empire. We can beat it now, once and for all, finish it off, if we get this entire global perspective.
Well, we only have a minute left, so I think that winding up on just the point you're making, and that's what you probably saw, I mentioned, over these new paradigm conferences, you would say you were now seeing the potential come into a yet more intense reality here.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm sure these conferences will proceed, but we're in a very different geometry from these last few weeks. What's happened in these last few weeks was a world changer. You know, think about it. Here, the U.S. and the Russians are actually potentially working together to counter the British-Saudi war plan. It's a transformation, potentially, of everything that's been done to the United States since the killing of Kennedy 50 years ago. This is a great moment. It could collapse. You know, this can be sabotaged. But we have the potential for unleashing a true renaissance for mankind, and we simply have to act with that sense of our having the rare privilege of being alive at this great moment in history.
Yes, and thank you very much for being on this hour. And so we will conclude. This is September 21, 2013, The LaRouche Show. Thanks to Mike Billington, our Asia editor, for being on the show today. This is Marcia Mary Baker signing off. Thank you.
Great. Bye-bye.